David here. Tonight's podcast is a three-parter. There's going to be a quick bulletin, a news bulletin, as it were. And then I've got something for you. I'm going to give you a copy of a key. And finally, we're going to visit a house and meet the guy who lived there. So a three-parter. We'll start with the bulletin. I've been reading about the attempts to deal with cholera in the 1840s, and I came across it's 13-worder in the book I'm reading. It says, the city had London's highest cholera death rate, yet declared its sanitation perfect. And I thought, where have I heard that before? In fact, I've heard that pretty much practically every other day, it seems like, for the last 140 days. Look, it's been a shambles the way this government has handled this pandemic, an absolute shambles. But again and again, we're told, well, our test and trace system is a world beater. It's second to none, et cetera, et cetera. So, it turns out there's form in this country in these things. In the 1840s, the city had the highest cholera death rate, yet it declared its sanitation perfect. Where have we heard that before? Now, the key. I've been doing this for 40 years. I've been a London Walks guide for 40 years. Nobody's been doing this longer than I have. And this is a difficult city to read. It's a difficult place to figure out. And over the course of those four decades, I've come up with, I've discovered, I call them keys. It's like I've got a key ring with 15 or 16 keys on it, and they help to make sense of the place. They help to unlock this most mysterious of cities. And I'm going to give you one of the 16 tonight, and that simply is the importance of names, of place names in London. They very often, a place name can be an X-ray of a place. It'll show you the past, or at least an important part of the past, or it will reveal to you, some of the DNA of a place, a neighborhood, a street, etc. Now, I said this is a three-parter. The third part, we're going to Chelsea. We're going to look at a house in Chelsea, a very special house. So I thought, let's start this by doing something with the name itself, Chelsea. It's a two-syllable name. And the last syllable, E, it's very old. It's Anglo-Saxon. It's very common in London. If you open your ears, you hear it all over London. Chelsea, Putney, Stepney, Hackney, Battersea, Bermondsey, Thorny, etc. And what this old Anglo-Saxon suffix means is the rising ground of above the surrounding wetlands. The first syllable in the name Chelsea, the best guess is something like Chalk Wharf. That's the name for us. And now let's go to our house. It's in Cheney Row. There's a row There are 10 houses there. It's a row of Queen Anne houses. They date from the first decade of the 18th century. Today they're numbered 16 to 34. And along with the houses in Queen Anne's Gate in Westminster, these are the best representatives of domestic architecture in London of that period. But the one I'm really interested in tonight, the one we're going to go to, it's number 24 today. It was number 5 when our distinguished resident pitched up in 1834. And this house, 24, is really one of London's greatest literary shrines, perhaps the greatest one of all. It was the Thomas Carlyle. He was born in Scotland, humble beginnings, walked 6 miles to school at the start of his school day and 6 miles back at the end of it. But he came with Jane, his wife, came to live in Chelsea in 1834. They came to what is today number 24. I mentioned his walking 12 miles a day. Well, Carlyle was very impressed by the transport services that he had there in Chelsea. Obviously, the River Thames was right there, so they could get boats. But he wrote to Jane, and he said, "Chelsea abounds more than any other place in omnibi." I love that. He gets the plural Latin right. It's not omnibuses, but omnibi. But you know, when you think about 1834, there's the railway has not come along. There's no tube. When they came down to London, they came by vessel, by ship, by boat. That was a 5-day voyage, 5 days, from Edinburgh to London. But he went on about these omnibi. He said, "They take you to Coventry Street for sixpence." And, you know, I fastened on that Coventry Street. I thought, well, why? I wonder why he said Coventry Street. And then, of course, it was immediately obvious to me. Coventry Street really links Piccadilly Circus and Leicester Square. But when he's writing this in the early 1830s, Trafalgar Square doesn't exist. Shaftesbury Avenue doesn't exist. So Coventry Street must have been the kind of most central street in the London of their day. And that's why he pinpoints that one. But this house, it really was a literary mecca. They were all there. It's kind of unchanged. It's so easy. Tennyson was visiting all the time. And he and Carlyle would smoke clay pipes in the garden. When you go to the house and when you get to that front door, one thing you can stop and think about before you enter is John Stuart Mill standing there dreading what was about to happen, and then, you know, not ringing the bell, but banging on the knocker, because he'd brought the news of what had happened to the first part, the manuscript of Carlyle's great work, his History of the French Revolution. Carlyle had given that first volume, that manuscript, to Mill to annotate, to proofread, and he left it on a side table. An illiterate Irish housemaid came by, spotted this stack of paper, and assumed that it was waste paper, And the whole thing went into the fireplace and went up in flames. Well, you know, you can imagine what that was like for John Stuart Mill having to bring that news to Carlyle. You can imagine what it was like for Carlyle. But it's a measure of the man. It's a measure of Carlyle that, you know, it must have been devastating. But he sat down and he wrote it over right from scratch. Word about the marriage, this was a terribly unhappy marriage. Samuel Butler said of this marriage, Thomas Carlyle and Jane, he said, "It was very good of God to let Carlyle and Mrs. Carlyle marry one another and so make only two people miserable and not four." She predeceased him. She died in 1866. She was, out riding while she was in a carriage that was taking her on a ride in Hyde Park. And the driver said a few things to her, or kind of over his shoulder, and there was no reply. And then he stopped and looked back. And, it was pretty apparent that that she had died. When you go to Carlyle's house, you might like to bear in mind that Carlyle died in the drawing room of the house. His last words were, "So, this is death. Well." I said he liked the garden, and he wrote in the garden, but he preferred the garret, his large room, and he had it made himself. It was windowless, although it did have a skylight, but he was maddened by the racket and noise in the neighborhood, so it was double-walled to free him from the cacophony of, as he said, dogs, cocks, pianofortes, and insipid men. But let's sort of bring this to a close by, a couple of things. I've dug out a few responses, a few descriptions from other writers about that house. Well, actually, we start first with Carlyle himself. He wrote this to his mother. He said, "We lie safe in a little bend of the river, away from all the great roads, have an air and quiet hardly inferior to Craigenputtock," that's in Scotland, his native Scotland, "an outlook from the back windows into more leafy regions, with here and there a red, high-peaked old roof looking through, and see nothing of London except by day the summits of St. Paul's Cathedral and Westminster Abbey, and by night the gleam of the great Babylon affronting the peaceful skies. The house itself is probably the best we have ever lived in, a right old, strong, roomy brick house, built nearly 150 years ago, and likely to see three races of these modern fashionables fall before it comes down." Now, there was a historian, not largely forgotten, but a guy named Frederick Harrison. He was a sort of historian and a jurist. And he visited Carlyle in 1872, and he wasn't impressed at all with Chelsea. He says, "I was struck with humiliation when I went to see the old prophet of Chelsea. He seems to live in a very dismal corner of this foul city. When I thought of the poor, soured, wild old genius coiling himself up in his own virtue in that alley where one might expect to find one's washerwoman, I could not help contrasting it with the luxurious and lovely scenery wherein sundry articles against luxury are produced in the royal palace of the bard at Blackdown, who is, after all, but an organ grinder to the true bard at Chelsea. And do you know who the bard at Blackdown is that he's referring to? It's Tennyson himself. Finally, the American Oliver Wendell Holmes pitched up in Chelsea, and he went around to take a look. This is 5 years after Carlyle had died, but he wasn't impressed either with the place. He described it as the dingy three-story brick house was far from attractive. It was untenanted, neglected, its windows were unwashed, a pane of glass was broken, its threshold appeared untrodden, its whole aspect forlorn and desolate. And let's really end with, well, a little bit of Carlyle himself. Some of his words. I mean, the man was, after all, a writer. I think maybe the best known of his quotables. Many of you will recognize this. He said, it was Carlyle who said, "Genius is an infinite capacity for taking pains." It was Carlyle who dubbed economics the dismal science. Carlyle said, "History is the biography of great men." I like this. He said, "The real use of gunpowder is to make all men tall." He spoke of England's pursuit of money, money, and one folly and another. And this is rather good as well. You can think of Jeff Bezos, for example, when you hear this quote. "Everywhere in life, the true question is not what we gain, but what we do." Not bad, that. Or how about this? "The eye sees what it brings the power to see." Carlyle said, "The greatest university of all is a collection of books." Carlyle said, "The greatest of faults, I should say, is to be conscious of none." He said, "What we become depends on what we read after all of the professors have finished with us." Carlyle said, "Blessed is he who has found his work." And this one's rather good. "Make yourself an honest man, and then you may be sure there is one less rascal in the world." But my two favorite ones, "The Work of an Unknown Good Man." The work an unknown good man has done is like a vein of water flowing hidden underground, secretly making the ground green. And finally, "Adversity is the diamond dust heaven polishes its jewels with." And 2 points to end. Carlyle was really the driving force behind the London Library. I'm a member of the London Library. It's not cheap. It costs me nearly £1,000 a year. It's a subscription library. But it enables me to do two things that I can't do, for example, at the British Library. One, I can go into the Saxe. And it's very often the case that if you're in the Saxe, and you're looking for a certain book, out of the corner of your eye, you will spot a title that you didn't know about. And it turns out it's the best possible work, the best possible book for what you're working on. Now, if you go to the British Library, that's just not, you cannot go into those stacks. They fetch them for you. You order them up. Now it's done by computer. And they fetch them for you. And also at the London Library, and again, this is not the case at the British Library, you can take the books home. And that's a great joy being able to do that. Funny, of course, the setting is wonderful. It's in St. James's Square. It's the closest the likes of me will ever get to a gentleman's club. The reading room is these leather-covered armchairs. And if you nod off, providing you're not snoring too loudly, they'll just leave you in peace until closing times. But he started it because, well, at the British Library, Lord Macaulay, who was, of course, an aristocrat, nobleman, and he was getting preferential treatment. And, you know, Carlyle was the grandson of a carpenter, that sort of thing. And it drove him crazy that this upper-class Englishman was being favored over him. So he just rolled up his sleeves, got on with it, and he really midwived, if you will, the London Library. And, you know, it's one of the great, great London institutions. Finally, my best American pal, this is another David, he divides his time between Madison, Wisconsin, and Manhattan, and in normal times, he travels a lot. And David is a list maker. In fact, he carries that little notebook in his pocket, and if he comes across in a conversation or in something he's reading, a place that he hasn't been to, and he knows London very well. He's lived in London for a couple of years. He's been here many, many times. He loves it. He loves England, etc., etc. But he's got this. He keeps this list going, and something will go onto his list, and then when he gets here, he'll go to these places, and he ticks these places off. He works through his list. Well, I'm pretty sure that one, David might listen to this, but two, Carlyle's house, because of what I've just said about it over the last 10 minutes or so, it'll make it onto my best friend's list. Okay, that's it. Good night. See you tomorrow. Ciao.